is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The late 20th century, Desert Storm and Desert Shield. These many decades later, it is time to memorialize and celebrate the men and women who participated in what now is regarded as the opening act of a crisis in the Middle East that is ongoing, that has seen the U.S. Army committed again and again to keeping peace or fighting adversaries in the region. And there might not be an end to this. However, Desert Storm and Desert Shield were clearly the place to begin. And I welcome Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, CBS News, Dickinson College. He is the CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. Diamond Six was the colonel's call signal when he participated in this war. But we need to do some fundamentals here. Jeff, a very good evening to you. The memorial is to be dedicated in Washington, D.C. to pay tribute to you and your colleagues. What was the Gulf War? When did the Gulf, the Kuwait War, the Gulf War as it began, Desert Storm and Desert Shield, when did you first hear about it and what did it mean to you? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you, John. Well, we first heard about it on the 2nd of August, 1990. We were actually doing training in Germany. And that's when Saddam Hussein directed Iraqi military to invade and occupy Kuwait, declaring it a province of Iraq. On the 7th of August, President George Herbert Walker Bush announced Desert Storm, which was the deployment of U.S. military forces, particularly light forces, 101st Air Mobile, 82nd primarily, to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to defend the Saudis against a possible further attack on the oil fields along the Gulf Coast from the Iraqis and have that force in place to deter, if not defend, Saudi Arabia from advance. From then on, of course, things moved to, diplomatically to a condemnation worldwide of the Iraqi invasion. And on the 29th of November, the UN Security Council authorized the use of force to evict the Iraqis formally from Kuwait. President Bush also sent additional U.S. military forces to the region to bolster those who were there to give us the offensive capabilities. So that became from Desert Shield defending to Desert Storm preparing for the attack. And that's when my unit arrived a little after Thanksgiving in 1990. Ultimately, 700,000 U.S. military forces would deploy, along with forces from 39 other countries. The Iraqis had an ultimatum to withdraw by the 15th of January. They did not. On the 16th of January, a massive air campaign began, which went on until the 24th of February, when we formally invaded Iraq with the big left hook by 7th Corps and on into Kuwait, defeating the Iraqis in around 100 hours or so, and evicting their forces from Kuwait.
My memory is that there was an array of nation states participating, a large collection of military units, and including Saudi Arabia. I remember vividly Saudi Arabian fighter pilots participating in the combat with the Iraqi forces. Why was that possible then, something that is not seen as credible now? What was the atmosphere 30 years ago that has changed profoundly, Jeff?
Well, I think the first thing was that the United States was the unitary global power. The Soviet Union was experiencing grave difficulties, and of course, the Soviet Union would formally collapse in December of 1991. Second of all, people like Mikhail Gorbachev, who was trying vainly to work out closer relations with the United States and salvage what he saw as a deteriorating government, supported action in the UN Security Council with authorized that resolution to evict forces. And the international community lined up, sort of not ironically, not unlike we're seeing it line up now, to stand against aggression by one country against another. But you're right, John, not only did most of the NATO countries, French, British, and others contribute forces, Middle Eastern countries, and not only the Saudis, but actually we had an Egyptian division fighting with us. We had a Syrian division fighting with us. And even the Mujahideen Taliban from Afghanistan sent about 500 fighters to Saudi Arabia to fight with the coalition to formally evict the Iraqis from Kuwait.
The expectation was casualties and disaster. That did not happen. The array of equipment and material and the war plans were successful right away. I remember the number 100 hours. Do I remember correctly, Jeff?
Well, that's the number they used, I think, for publicity purposes. Actually, the war for us went on a little longer. We were actually, as part of the elite attack force, into Iraq about a day in advance. So, but 100 hours is the phrase that the Bush administration liked for the war. But you're right, Johnny, as the war began, the expectations were of high casualties, a great fear that the Iraqis would use chemical, if not biological, agents. And we entered in the invasion force all wearing our MOP gear, our mission protective posture chemical gear, throughout this particular offensive. I was told in brief by my commander, as part of the lead element into Iraq, we might expect as high as 80% casualties. The casualties were very small, and the advance moved much more rapidly than we even expected. Total casualties for the United States in this conflict, including non-hostile deaths, were about 1,000 killed and injured. Several hundred more of our coalition allies were also killed or injured in the conflict. As far as casualties for the Iraqis, it's largely unknown, John, how many Iraqis perished in this particular struggle. I've seen estimates of a few thousand to as high as over 100,000. I would actually probably suggest it was the higher number based on 6 weeks of an air campaign and just the massive mechanized warfare that we executed, destroying massive amounts of Iraqi military equipment.
What was the highway of death, Jeff? How did that happen?
The highway of death, which I was sitting on the last night of the war, was a highway that connected Kuwait City with Basra, the port city of Iraq. It's a four-lane highway that goes up right along the coast of the Gulf. As we came in from the west and U.S. and coalition forces were advancing from the south, Iraqi forces began to evacuate rapidly from Kuwait City in a sheer rout. They were just rushing away in panic. It was not an organized withdrawal. And that highway was crowded with not only military vehicles, trucks, tanks, armored personnel carriers, but also private cars. I saw tons of private cars the Iraqi military had stolen, loaded with loot, heading up the highway. As they were heading up there in that route, U.S. Air Force, particularly A-10 aircraft, just pulverized this particular highway full of vehicles. When we arrived, we'd also struck it with artillery. And I can remember being on that highway at night, just massive wreckage of vehicles of all type, explosions as fires struck gas tanks and ammunition on those vehicles. And to make it even more Kafkaesque, John, the backdrop beyond that highway, of course, were all the oil fields, which were ablaze because Saddam Hussein, during the retreat, had ordered that all the oil fields in Kuwait be lit up and put on fire as his forces retreated.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. I have that image in my mind. There was talk that those oil fields were spreading poison that damaged our troops. Your colleagues and you, do you see evidence of that today, Jeff?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. There's been a massive effort on the part of the Veterans Administration to reach out to veterans, not only the Gulf War, but subsequent so-called burn pit injuries based on respiratory diseases and the like inflicted on U.S. military forces by inhaling those of us who were right there in the middle of all these fires, and as well as those who just suffered it from the burning of all kinds of trash and materiel, which were routinely burned in large burn pits during the Gulf War and subsequently wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But to give you an idea, John, I remember the cloud of smoke normally hung around the coast because of the prevailing winds. But if you drove out there, as I had to on a couple of occasions, as soon as you got under the cloud, the temperature would drop about 20 to 30 degrees from being out in the sunlight on the desert. And sometimes when the wind would shift and blow onto the land, it would be like twilight all day long because the cloud of smoke was so thick it would block out the sun.
The memorial to Desert Storm and Desert Shield in Washington, D.C., I read that President Obama signed the legislation in 2014. President Trump signed off building the memorial. And this, it's going to be near the Lincoln Memorial. Whereabouts, Jeff? So if someone visiting Washington can find it.
Yeah, it's not going to be terribly far, John. It's 23rd and Constitution Avenue. It's not far from the Vietnam Memorial. You know, and it seems to me, John, these memorials are not only important for us to remember the sacrifice of those who serve, but the sacrifice of those families is important historical moments. It was also a time when the nation came together. And we talk a lot about polarization, but we came together in this particular struggle. And furthermore, many people point to it as the moment in our history when the estrangement between the U.S. People, the American people, and their military in the aftermath of the Vietnam War actually ended. and the military became an institution that Americans respected. And then, as you suggest as well, John, it was an interesting moment for not only the fact that the American people came together, but the world community came together once again to denounce uncalled for aggression by one power against a smaller country.
And here we are more than 30 years later and entertaining the same challenge of an aggressor state invading a sovereign state and what is to be done. However, now we can remember 30 years ago, Operation Desert Shield, that was the initial investiture of U.S. forces and others to stop the advance on further on Saudi Arabia. The plans were unclear, just as we could say today, you're never clear how far the aggressor will go. And that's why you respond as rapidly as possible with as much on the ground you can get there. Jeff McCausland, Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army, retired, CBS News. Diamond Six was his call letters, right, Jeff, for the operation. You were Diamond Six.
That was my radio call sign, John, as battalion commander during the war. And that's why I adopted that particular phrase as the name for my company, to remember those soldiers in that particular conflict.
Diamond Six, Leadership and Strategy, and Dickinson College. I'm John Batchelor.